Strengthen your immune system with Goldman Laboratories liposomal vitamin C and get 10% off. Quote 10 off at goldmanlaboratories.com.
Hello, welcome to the Yes Life Show on UK Health Radio. My name's Robin Daly, and I'm host for the show as well as founder of the UK charity Yes to Life, that for more than 15 years has been pushing forward the agenda for integration in cancer care, for the adoption of a far more rounded and inclusive form of care that addresses the many needs of those with cancer in body, mind and spirit. Today's show throws a spotlight on one of the heroes of our movement, the Movement for Integration. Long before Yes to Life existed, back at a time when my awareness of the issues around cancer care was just beginning to awaken, as my daughter Bryony was first diagnosed with cancer at age 9, Heather Goodair and a group of very determined women were fighting a battle against the entrenched establishment forces that was to pave the way for the advancements in care that are happening today. Heather is now approaching 90 and up against some challenging health issues, but her sparkling spirit is still in excellent health, and I'm lucky enough to be able to talk to her today over the internet. Hi Heather, it's an honour to have you on the Yes to Life show.
It's an honour to be on it.
So the thing that's prompted your appearance was having my attention drawn to your recently published book, Foiled Creative Fire. This is a study of remarkable women with breast cancer. But before we go on to talk about the book, I think it's important to acknowledge the long journey that you've been on personally in coming to writing it. You were diagnosed yourself with breast cancer more than 30 years ago now. I wonder if you could set the scene by telling us about your life and preoccupations leading up to that point, so before you were diagnosed.
Well, it was quite stressful, actually, because my first marriage broke up, and I'm sure that that was contributing to the cancer.
Right.
I married a Hungarian refugee, music student, and we were very happy, I thought, and we had a young son, and then he went off with somebody else, which was very sad. But he by then he'd become quite an eminent musicologist. And after that, I managed on my own somehow, but it was very difficult. Okay. And then I met again, Kenneth, who had the same experience with his first wife. By then he had 3 children. And we were both musicians. Music was a great thing.
Right.
And we married. But I was still really grieving for my first marriage. And I think that was what actually provoked the cancer. Because by then, all my family were either dead or they'd gone to Australia.
Oh.
My brother went to Australia. Mm. And he came back for a holiday and came to stay with us. And we spent a whole week talking.
Hmm.
And that really helped me a lot.
Right.
Because I had not had any sort of proper psychotherapy during the time that I was depressed. I just had oceans of antidepressants.
Oh, dear.
So, I mean, my GP was very nice and very good, but he just didn't understand that I needed to talk about it all. Anyway.
So you're a musician. Tell me a little about that.
Well, I led the second violins in the National Youth Orchestra, and I've always been a reasonably good quartet player, but not outstanding, and I've taken part in various orchestras, amateur orchestras, and my husband was not only a violinist and a viola player, Also, he played clarinet and saxophone. Wow. He's much more of a musician than I am, really.
Okay, and so anyway, you had this period of depression after the breakup of your marriage. How long did that last?
Well, I don't know, 4 or 5 years, I think.
Oh, quite a long time. Okay, and how long after that were you diagnosed?
It was about 3 years.
Right. Okay, so that's prompted a lot of your thinking about this subject, I imagine.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, just out of interest, how's your health been since your treatment? Because this is some time ago now.
Well, my right breast, was pretty bad, actually, because my oncologist gave me, I don't think she expected me to last very long because I had a poor prognosis. And she gave me large doses of radiotherapy every other day rather than small doses every day.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think she expected me to last more than 5 years.
Right.
But I went to the Bristol Centre and learned a lot about diet and so on. And I think that's why I survived.
Interesting.
But my breast developed lumps of fibrosis, which I'm sure were due to the radiotherapy.
Hmm.
And I found that acupuncture actually helped with that, and I'm still having it.
All right. Interesting. So just to be clear to listeners today who don't know that Pennybron UK used to be called Bristol Cancer Help Centre, and that's what you're referring to, the place you found. So this was, give me a date around then, where are we talking about, 1980-something?
Yes, 1989.
1989, and what age would you have been then?
My age now is nearly 90.
90, okay, so you're about 60, around 60,
yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so I wanted to ask you about Pennybron or Bristol Cancer Help Centre because you had a bit more involvement than just going there for your own support, I understand.
I didn't.
Yeah, because they needed a bit of support of their own. They went through an unbelievably tough experience there. Do you want to tell us a bit about that?
Yes, well, I was actually one of the women involved in that because they asked me if I'd like to take part in this research project. And I said, OK. And we had to fill in questionnaires mm-hmm. every year. And I kept one or two of them. But it was supposed to be a 5-year study, but after only 2 years, they published something in The Lancet, which was awful because it was an appalling study, and they didn't get their facts right. And the conclusion was that women who go to Bristol die sooner.
Yeah, I remember. It was quite a thing. So why did this get published after 2 years? Do you know why this happened?
I don't know why. But anyway, we got together a group of women who had taken part in this study, and I don't know why they published it so early, and it was such a poor study, but anyway, they did. I don't think it's ever been retracted, actually, but
really?
Certainly it's been rubbished.
Right.
I think it's been rubbished.
Mm.
And I got together with about 20 other women who had been in the study.
Mm-hmm.
We formed a Bristol Survey Support Group, and we challenged it all.
Yeah, because basically, I mean, the whole thing was on the, it was just a sort of shutdown situation where it was exposed on the BBC, wasn't it?
Yes,
that place was just going to be shut down, basically, on the basis of that trial.
Yes. but we women in the study made a real fuss about it and wrote this book called Fighting Spirit. And eventually it was decided that it was not a good study, and the Charity Commission made new rules for charitably funded research. And because this was sponsored by the Imperial Cancer Research Fund and the Cancer Research Campaign, both of which have now combined to form Cancer Research UK.
CRUK, anyway. It was a shocking story, and I have to say that I think if that battle had been lost, the course of integrative medicine, well, it's been, unconscionably slow in Britain anyway, but if that battle had been lost, I dread to think where we'd be now. I think it was a major turning point in the development of integrative cancer care.
Yes.
So if you imagine Pennybron being shut down at that point, or cancer, Bristol Cancer Help Centre being shut down, I think, that would have been a precedent for quashing any other initiatives to help people with cancer in any way other than drugs and radiotherapy.
Yes. But now, Pennybron is now featured in the Royal Society of Medicine building.
Right. It's quite a change, isn't it? Well, I think you can take, you and your group can take a lot of the credit for the fact that it is the way it is. I mean, I think it really was a turning point.
It was.
So that's one way in which you rolled up your sleeves and got engaged in the world of oncology, other than the personal side. But there's only one, and I think you've been engaged in a lot of other ways in the last few decades. Do you want to tell us about some of those key ones?
Well, I've founded a support group in Crawley, where I was living at the time, when I was living in Horsham at the time. And that was a really important thing for me. And also I trained as a counsellor, because... Oh. I realised that there weren't enough people like me in counselling. So anyway, I trained as a counsellor, and I used my skills individually as well as for the group.
Mm-hmm.
And I did get paid, but only really, which covered my supervision,
Right. You're doing it for the love of it.
Yes, absolutely. And I found that with the people I was working with, they all had the same story.
Right.
Most of them had breast cancer, and most of them said, how it all started. It was when my husband walked out, or when I had a handicapped child born. Or, some sort of incident where my son went to prison. So that was the trouble.
Interesting. So you were generally amassing this information as you went along, at least mentally, the fact that this is something that's not really being talked about enough. This connection.
And in those days, there wasn't any proper research on it, but now there is.
Oh, yeah.
There's quite a lot of research on the way that mental health can impinge on physical health.
Yeah, I'm glad to say you're right, that we do have something to back it up now. It's taken seriously. Great. And I think there's more, isn't there? Isn't it right you were chair of one of the breast cancer charities for a number of years?
Yes.
Do you have a recollection of what you hoped to achieve, and maybe some of the things you did manage to achieve doing that?
Well, certainly, we managed to achieve a much better participation of patients in committees and so on.
Right.
I mean, when I first was diagnosed, people didn't even talk about breast cancer.
Right.
In fact, I remember going to the in the oncology clinic, I went for my radiotherapy, and I wanted to put a notice up on the board about a support group.
Right.
And the sister said, "Oh, no, you can't do that." I said, "Why not?" She said, "Well, some of the ladies here don't know they've got cancer."
All right. Well, that was how it was. Yeah, it's how it was. It's amazing, really, to think that within my lifetime, cancer's gone from being something that really wasn't talked about at all. It is now fairly freely talked about, even amongst men who are much more reticent. They will talk about the fact they've got prostate cancer, and it maybe even have an awareness they have a prostate, which was not the case a few years ago. So things have moved on in that way. And I think what you just highlighted, that the need for patient involvement is incredibly important. Yeah. If we want cancer care to get better, we have to be in there saying what we want, what we need.
Exactly. Yes, I was a member of various groups in Edinburgh. There was a research group. And, I mean, it's so important that patients are involved. And the organisation that does include patients, research organisation. Cochrane Collaboration.
Ah, the Cochrane Collaboration. Well, yeah, again, enormously important body there, overviewing research and seeing what's actually good research and what's not so good and what research needs doing.
Absolutely.
You know, one of the things that's very readily apparent to anybody who's got cancer, that an awful lot of the research is about things that are not even relevant, really, to people with cancer, and they're not the questions they want answered.
No, exactly.
Well, it says here you were the first patient representative on the British Medical Journal editorial board, so that's pretty damned important.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, when we came to Edinburgh, which was in 2003, mm-hmm. I said, I've done enough now. I'm just going to retire. But of course, I gave up my counselling because that would have involved supervision and so on, and I just didn't want to continue with it. But when I started writing the book, Bold Creative Fire, that was about 20 years ago.
Right, it's been in the making a long time.
Yes. It has, because I got involved in other things like Friends of the Meadows and Bunsfield Links. I became the chair of that, and that was another charity. And I got involved with the local community councils and so on. And I started a group called the Edinburgh Health Forum.
Right.
And so we've been beavering away on various local issues.
Right.
Nothing to do with cancer, but you know, well, obviously cancer came into it. But
okay, so but in the background, there's something going along all the time here, in as much as this book has finally emerged. So you've been engaged with it yourself throughout the whole period, which is over a long period. And here we have this book, Foiled Creative Fire. So it's a study of remarkable women with breast cancer. So this has obviously started right back there when you first started talking to other women. The title, okay, that people will be wondering, well, what's that about? So do you want to just tell us why you called it that?
Because I just liked the phrase, Foiled Creative Fire. I can't now remember exactly why I chose that, but it was from a poem by W.H. Auden.
Mm-hmm.
Childless women get it, and men when they retire, it's as if there had to be some outlet for their foiled creative fire. This is from a poem called Miss G.
All right.
By W.H. Auden.
Mm.
And that really sums up the reason.
So there are things you've sought to tie together between the lives of the women you've written about and this ability to express themselves, if you like, express their creativity. Would that be right?
Yes.
And yes. Does this also apply to you? Is it your own experience as well?
Yes. Yes. I think when I started being creative, then that's when the healing started.
Right. Interesting.
I mean, I'm in a fairly miserable state at the moment. I went and had a stroke, which is very silly, because it affected my right side. So, I mean, it's not completely debilitating, but it has affected me quite a bit.
Yeah.
I think the stroke was because of the radiotherapy on my breast and, you know, the long-term effects of radiotherapy.
They go on and
spread.
On.
They go on and on.
They do.
And,
okay, so do you want to sort of introduce us to some of the women that you chose to write about and why they're in the book?
Yes, well, I start off with Anne of Austria. In fact, what's so interesting is that I just started off with these eminent women in history who'd had breast cancer.
Right.
And I hadn't thought originally when I chose them that they all had the same problem. That is, they all had some major mental issue before their cancer. And that's why I found it so interesting. Anne of Austria, Queen of France. She was early 17th century. And then the next one is Sœur Marie Barbier de l'Assomption. She was a Canadian woman. A nun. It's a very small biography of her. I mean, she's an example not so much of mental issues as general issues of women who became nuns because they are frustrating their natural desires.
Right.
And then there's Fanny Burney, the novelist.
Right.
She had a very interesting life, half in France and half in the UK. She had lots of problems, but she survived. And Christine Rossetti. Everyone knows about Christina's life. And then the Princess Victoria, the Empress Friedrich III. She had lots and lots of setbacks and problems. And she survived.
Yeah, some of them do seem to be extraordinary survivors against the most unbelievable odds. Some of these stories are really grueling, aren't they?
Yes. Then Kate Greenaway.
Right.
And then Rachel Carson. Rachel Carson, you know about her because of the climate problems.
Yeah, she was well ahead of her time, wasn't she?
She was. Kathleen Ferrier. Kathleen Ferrier, the singer.
Singer, yes. She died tragically young, didn't she?
Yes. Vanessa Bell was one of the Bloomsbury lot. Joan Eardley was the artist. She was a lesbian. At a time when lesbianism was not allowed. And then Susan Sontag. She really quarrelled with the idea of the cancer personality. But anyway, she obviously had it.
Interesting. Do you want to say a few words about that? Because that's not something everybody's come across. But there is this sort of talk of a cancer personality, quite commonly applied to women, I think. Do you want to say a bit more about it?
Well, they are supposed to be inward-looking and blaming themselves for everything.
This is something that's it is spoken about quite a bit these days. But anyway, interesting. You're saying Susan Sontag actually thought it was rubbish, even though you think she had that personality.
Yes, I do.
Yeah,
I do.
Yeah.
And then Audre Lorde. She is the last person in the book. is a coloured woman.
Yes, almost brings you up to date then, doesn't it? This is almost contemporary, end of the 20th century.
I didn't want to include anyone who was actually alive.
No, fair enough. Yeah, interesting. So one of the things that really struck me, I mean, you mentioned yourself in, when you were telling us about your own journey, that you spent a number of years feeling quite depressed. Well, depression runs through this book, like, you know, on every page virtually, doesn't it? All of these women had to deal with depression in at some time or in some form, sometimes majorly and at regular intervals through their lives. So it's either a case of depression is so common that if you lift the covers, you're going to find it anywhere. I mean, that's one possibility. Or it is very much connected here with this condition, with breast cancer. I mean, the fact that all these women have breast cancer and suffered major bouts of depression is certainly looks way beyond coincidental, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. But how do you treat it? I mean, today there's this huge, great problem with depression and anxiety, which is associated with the present knowledge in medical research. That's the point I wanted to make.
Right.
I would also say that today we're going through a major crisis of mental health.
Absolutely.
And there are no counsellors in GP surgeries. I mean, in my GP surgery, there's a physiotherapist, but no counsellor or psychotherapist.
Mm.
And I find that that's so in most GP surgeries. And I think that, you know, mental health really needs to be put top of the list. And because I know that in my local surgery and in others around the place, people have to wait at least 6 months to see a psychiatrist.
Right.
And during that time, I'm afraid there are suicides.
Absolutely.
So there ought to be a psychotherapist in every GP surgery. One in four cases in Scotland are mental, not physical.
Right. So you're right, it's a crisis, and the resources are not there for it. And very interestingly, we're tying up depression with getting a chronic condition such as breast cancer, and also you tied up creative fire with getting better, with recovery.
Yes.
And now, of course, depression and creative fire are worlds apart. They're opposite ends of the spectrum. They're mutually exclusive, I would say, aren't they?
Yes, they are. Absolutely.
So it's very important what you're talking about. You're talking about part of the reason that leads people to be ill, and part of the solution to their illness are all associated with this mental condition, and which is being overlooked to a horrible extent.
Yes, absolutely.
So this is the reason you wanted to write this book, I assume. You were trying to move this up the agenda.
Yes, because I couldn't talk about the people that I was working with at the time, because they were off limits, obviously.
Right.
So I had to go historical.
Okay, well, it's very interesting. I think, as a topic to be shared amongst people, it's a very interesting one. I mean, you know, this is the age of the public forum of people talking to each other on the internet about what's going on for them. So there may not be the support we'd like to see, but there certainly are other people to talk about it with who know the experience for themselves. And maybe a lot could be learned from that.
Yes.
So maybe it'd be interesting to just talk a little bit more about this creative fire, since that's the title of your book. It seems like the women you wrote about had different relationships with that. Some of them who were quite clearly foiled completely, whereas others seemed to go on expressing their huge creativity in many instances, despite all the odds. And did you interpret anything from the differences between the different women's lives in that way?
I never thought about that, actually. But obviously, every woman is different. I mean, I was not creative at all before I had cancer.
How about that?
And had went through all it. But I think going to the Bristol Centre really helped me a lot. And I say I did work for them for a bit as a sort of informal helper.
Right, right.
I mean, I'm fading away now a bit.
Yeah.
Because I had this stroke, which affected my right side. I mean, I can just about type, thank goodness, but I can't write properly in my right hand.
Frustrating.
Very frustrating.
Yeah. Anyway, maybe we just round off just to say congratulations on the coming to the end of your 20-odd year project to write this book. You must have been pleased to have finally got it to the printers. And it must have taken a level of determination not to have dropped it at some point completely.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it was only because the care staff from Edinburgh City Council came and helped my husband and me with domestic stuff that I managed to finish it.
Oh, fantastic. Right.
He had a massive stroke
in
1988, I think it was. And he can't move really much.
Wow. So you need a lot of support.
So I have to look after him as well.
Yeah, you've got a lot on your plate. Well, anyway, as I say, huge congratulations, and I hope it achieves what you're looking for in terms of raising awareness further of the importance of the mind-body connection and how much this plays into our health.
I hope so. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. It's been great to meet you, and as I say, a real honour to talk to you, because the importance that I place on that victory that you had with your group of women back there with Bristol Cancer Help Centre is major. I just think it's, as I say, an absolute turning point. And if you hadn't done that, I dread to think where we'd be now.
I know.
All right. Thanks so much. Very best to you.
Well, great pleasure to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
What a wonderful woman Heather is. You probably became aware of the tinkling of violin music in the background throughout the interview, which I think will have been playing for her musician husband, who she cares for. I hope it didn't distract from your enjoyment of meeting Heather. She's a shining example of exactly what she's written about in her book. In fact, she could easily be the subject of the last chapter herself, given the way she overcame a very poor prognosis and has lived on, at this point, for another 30 years, during which time she's not only helped achieve a victory for Bristol Cancer Help Centre, but done a vast amount for others with cancer, culminating in her publication of Foiled Creative Fire, despite immense personal challenges. Heather's memories of all her astounding achievements in the last 30 years are fading now, but I want to mention that she is a member of the British Holistic Medical Association, a Life Fellow of the Royal Society of Medicine. She was the first patient representative on the British Medical Journal editorial board. She's peer-reviewed and written for medical and psychological books and journals, written many articles on the patient's perspective in research, and PPI, that's public and patient involvement. And for 5 years, she was chair of Breast Cancer UK. So we have much to be grateful to Heather for, not least that key role she played in restoring the credibility of what is now called lifestyle medicine, and thereby creating the potential for the integration that is just now beginning in the UK. Clearly, Heather herself hasn't suffered from foiled creative fire, at least for the last 3 decades or so. As I mentioned in the introduction, I'm the chair and founder of the UK charity Yes to Life, which has itself faced many challenges over the years from opponents of integration. But right now is challenged by the funding environment resulting from 3 years of Brexit, followed by a drawn-out pandemic. In an attempt to bolster the coffers, I'm making a 70th birthday trek across southern England, from Land's End to the eastern tip of Kent, by e-mountain bike, keeping off-road as far as possible. It's a 525-mile trip and it involves hills that all add up to a little more than the height of Everest. So I'm really hoping you'll consider helping me to raise £25,000 for Yes to Life. The event's called Robin's Senior Struggle and you can find details on Facebook and Just Giving, so do follow me there to keep abreast of all the action. Thanks so much for listening today. I'll be back at the same time next week with another Yes to Life show here on UK Health Radio. Bye. Thank you.